Welcome to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now your host, Jared Serbu.
5 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Thanks for listening to On DoD. Good afternoon. I'm Jared Serbu. Glad you're with us. The Army Reserve has just undergone a big leadership change. The longest-serving chief of the reserve, Lieutenant General Jack Stoltz, retired this summer. He handed over the reins to Lieutenant General Jeffrey Talley, who's now the chief of the reserve and the commanding general of Army Reserve Command. During our hour-long interview at his Pentagon office, we talked about doing less with less as the reserve moves from a period of abundant funding to more constrained resources, and the entire military's effort to confront a rising tide of suicides by service members. Talley's been in command of the reserve since June 9th. I started by asking him what's the most interesting part of the job so far.
I think the most interesting part is how broad and how large the organization is. I mean, when intellectually, I think I could understand we're 205,000 soldiers and 12,600 civilians, and we're literally everywhere in our Army. But now what I've started to do is experience this. Everywhere I go in the Army, everywhere I go, actually, in the United States, I find another Army Reserve soldier in charge or leading something in our Army, as well as being a leader in the community or in their private and public sector civilian jobs. And so that's kind of the exciting part of the job is it's never boring. Every day you meet new people that are doing great things for America.
Mm-hmm. And when you came in, you issued what you call Rally Point 32, which is, I guess, your overall operational and strategic guidance. You want to talk about how that fits into the broader Army strategy and policy documents and what ways that's different from what the Army Reserve has been doing, if at all?
The way that I've led in the past, both in the as a member of the Army Reserve, but also in the private sector as a CEO and in academia, is I think good leaders provide guidance and direction. And so I've always provided guidance and direction to those who I think need it or to those who ask for it. And so I thought in this case it would be good for me to provide that guidance and direction in the form of a written document. And Rally Point was just that. When you've been in the offense for as long as we have been in the United States military, occasionally you'll rally the troops to issue new guidance and direction and then continue on to the offensive objective. And that's exactly what Rally Point was intended. It was a starting point for me taking over as the chief of the Army Reserve and as the commanding general, and to let those in the organization and those outside the organization understand what's important to me, both at the strategic level as the chief of the Army Reserves, but also at the operational level as the commanding general of the U.S. Army Reserve Command.
Mm-hmm.
Key to the rally point is the commander's intent. And so my opinion has been throughout my Army career that if you understand the commander's intent and you have some leadership ability and you have some resourcing, you really don't need anything else other than to be left alone and be allowed to lead and do your duty. And so specifically, I provided the strategic and operational intent in Rally Point and then listed out my priorities under both the chief of the Army Reserves and as the CG. And in many ways, they're not completely different than General Stoltz's, but there is some differences. And one of the differences is General Stoltz, who did a remarkable job as the previous CAR and CG,
mm-hmm.
he had a different environment with respect to funding. That the Army Reserve was very well funded for during his entire tenure because the nation was at war and we had special funding that was associated with those activities that would be given to the Army Reserves to help maintain our level of readiness. Well, now those funding and resources are going to come down, and so we've got to operate a little bit differently than we have in the past in order to make sure that we can stay ready and relevant for the Army.
Let's take those one by one, the strategic guidance and the operational guidance, if we could, starting with strategic. What's the intent there, if you can describe it briefly?
Well, I think at the strategic level, the most important thing is to get back to your earlier point, how are we nested with marching orders, which is the guidance from General Odierno, the Chief of Staff of the Army. And
right.
the first thing is how do we maintain and sustain our all-volunteer force? Because right now we have the best Army in the history of the United States, regardless of component. And that's all with volunteers. And so we want to maintain that quality Army with our all-volunteer force. And that will remain a strategic priority for the Army Reserves. A point that I wanted to emphasize in strategic priorities was our Army Reserve soldiers are predominantly traditional reservists. which means they are reservists who drill once a month and have a couple weeks of annual training in the summer, and their civilian job is what pays their mortgage or what pays their bills.
Right.
And so what I wanted to do was to have a more deliberate effort of making sure that they come from the best and the brightest of public and private sector. So that way, when you reach out and grab a unit or a capability from the Army Reserve, you're getting those civilian-acquired skills from both the public and private sector as delivered by that member of that Army Reserve unit. And so those are a couple of the points that I've emphasized in strategic priorities. Another one would be to continue our employers partnership program, because in the Army Reserve, a soldier may love being in the Army Reserve and want to stay in the Army Reserve, but their family is only going to let them stay in the Army Reserve if they feel that civilian employment is stable and positive. And so we have to really make sure that we not only reach out to support the soldier and the soldier's family, but also that civilian employer, to make sure that they feel comfortable with the value added that that reserve soldier is bringing to their civilian organization.
Mm-hmm. You talk about getting the best and the brightest from the private sector. Does that require a change in recruiting strategy, or is that already underway?
No, not really, because the Army Reserve is predominantly the combat support and combat service support element of our Army.
Mm-hmm.
And so because of that, we're known as enablers. So most of the Army's medical, transportation, logistics, engineer, civil affairs, most of those capabilities reside for the Army and the Army Reserves, which means they're normally tied to a technical skill set, which generally correlate to that civilian acquired skills or experiences that that soldier in the Army Reserves is doing day-to-day in their civilian job. So we don't have to really have any sort of change in how we recruit. It fits actually pretty nicely for what we're doing in the Army Reserves, where we're just going after those people that have those civilian acquired skills who are also in our Army Reserve, and then we just got to get them in the right leadership positions and the right units in our reserve component mm-hmm. to support the Army.
Under the operational side of the house, that part of the guidance, you talk about providing forces in the most cost-efficient manner possible. You want to talk about how you think the reserve brings value to the overall Defense Department?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the good news is, if there's any good news that's come out of 10 years of war, one of the positive statements is the reserve component has de facto become part of the operating force of our Army. And the reserve component is a great return on investment for America. Why is that? Well, first off, we represent a very good investment in terms of we don't cost a lot of money, and we provide unique capabilities that again, as I mentioned before, that take advantage of those civilian-acquired skills and experiences. And that's what makes us so valuable to the Army. So let's focus on maybe engineering as an example.
Sure.
When the Army looks for engineering, they want full spectrum engineering. So they want someone that can do combat effects engineering, construction effects engineering, perhaps design, build type engineering skills. Those engineering skills are much more readily available in the Army Reserve engineering community than they are in the active community. First off, you get an engineer that has an ABET engineering degree who practices and does engineering every day in the civilian sector, whether mm-hmm. it's in the public sector or the private sector. Now you get them to actually practice that in a military setting, and so you get the benefit of that civilian training, that civilian experience, and in the military experience as well. It's hard to maintain that complete technical capability in the active component at the same level. And so most of those technical experiences, they're honing those technical skills not in the military but in the civilian sector. So the Army benefits from that without actually paying for it. And the same is true in the medical profession, you know, basically any of the enabling capabilities we have in the Army Reserve. So the Army benefits because the military skill set that they're using is directly built upon those technical skill sets that they've developed in the civilian sector.
Mm-hmm. This year's Army Reserve posture statement talks about trying to grab the best and the brightest out of the active component of the Army and hold on to them in the reserve. Your predecessor talked about that a lot as well. Can you describe a little bit how exactly you plan to go about that?
Sure. The end strength for the Army Reserve was 206,000. We've been asked to come down to 205,000, and we're actually already at 205,000, so we're already there. But when you look within the Army Reserve, we are short mid-career officers and NCOs. Well, the active Army's got to come down and in strength.
Mm-hmm.
And as they come down and in strength, there's going to be quality mid-career NCOs and officers that will leave the active component. What we want to be able to do in the Army Reserve is capture those guys and gals that have combat experience, that are strong and great leaders, who want to start a new career in the civilian sector, hopefully in one of these more technical skill sets that I've been talking about, engineers, logisticians, transporters, civil affairs, and we want to get them into our formation. So one of the ways we're doing that is at transition points in the active Army, the Army Reserves has counselors there to try to help educate those regular Army NCOs and officers. So as they come off the active component but want to continue to serve their country as soldiers, they can do that in the Army Reserve, as well as allow us to help them perhaps even find a civilian job through our employer's partnership program.
Yeah, talk about that partnership program a little bit. How expansive is it? How much success have you had actually placing soldiers into those civilian jobs?
Well, I mean, I certainly can't take any credit for it. General Stoltz and the Army Reserves has worked hard at developing this over the past few years, and I think right now we're up to about 3,000 different companies and then some federal agencies. I recently did a signing of a memorandum agreement with Secretary Salazar, the Department of Interior, which was the first federal agency that had signed an employer's partnership agreement with the Army Reserve. But of those roughly 3,000 employers, what they've done is they've said, look, here's the skill sets that we're looking for, and they happen to match very closely the types of skill sets that we already employ in the Army Reserve. Mm-hmm. So all we're really doing is they tell us their needs. We provide our soldiers that are looking for employments or want to switch jobs in their civilian sector, and we just get the two together. And then, of course, the employer hires whoever they think is best for their civilian organization. But it's been a great partnership, both through private and public civilian employment, and that number continues to grow all the time.
Lieutenant General Jeff Talley is the new chief of the Army Reserve. After a short break, we'll talk more about what the Reserve's doing to bridge the gap between professional certifications, the ones service members earn in uniform, and what they need for similar civilian careers. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Servin. Welcome back to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbu. Thanks for listening. Talking this week with Lieutenant General Jeff Talley, sworn in just this past June as the new chief of the Army Reserve. We left off the last segment talking about the Reserve's plan to provide more predictability in deployments for both reservists and their civilian employers. On another front, Talley says the Reserve is trying to tackle a problem that's common to many transitioning service members, matching the credentials they earn in uniform with the equivalent professional certifications they need to succeed in civilian life.
That's a great question, and I'm actually really glad you asked it, because just yesterday I met with the Society of Manufacturing Engineering, which is a professional society that does certification and registrations for people in the manufacturing engineering industry.
Mm-hmm.
Now, why did I do that? Well, we just talked about the employer's partnership program. Well, what I want to do is expand the employer's partnership program now to include professional societies that do the registrations and certifications for the technical skill sets that really closely relate to all of the military occupational skills we have in the Army Reserves. And so the idea is by you being a member of the Army Reserves, you become more marketable in the civilian sector, because the military training we give you in a specific technical skill set correlates not only to a good civilian skill set, but also to getting certification and registration in the appropriate areas that you're working in. And so by partnering, just like we have with employers, now we're moving forward to partner with professional societies that give those registrations and certifications both nationally and in the states. And the Society of Manufacturing Engineers just happened to be the first group that I met with yesterday who are excited to partner with us.
That's great. And it seems like one benefit to that is the societies get some insight into what the military acquired skills actually mean and how they would translate into civilian certification needs and where there are gaps, if any, right?
Exactly. And the way that I explained it to them yesterday is the Army Reserve is a great investment for America. Well, now we take this employer's partnership program with the Army Reserve, and we build upon it these professional societies that provide the certification and registrations that all the civilian employers want.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're reinvesting in America. How are you reinvesting in America? You're reinvesting in America by investing in the Army Reserve, investing in these professional societies who in turn generate capability for America, for American companies, for American jobs. To me, it's all about reinvesting in America, not only through the Army Reserve, but through our partners.
As we transition out of Afghanistan, I know one of the things you want to do is, you know, maintain this operational reserve. What does that mean for the life of an average reservist? I mean, do we go back to the traditional peacetime, you know, drill for 1 week in a month and 2 weeks a year, or does that change a little bit in the coming years?
It will have to change, and it is changed. In order for us to stay ready and relevant, we've got to make sure that when the Army and the Joint Force needs the Army Reserve's unique capabilities, that we have those capabilities to give and provide to the nation. How do we intend to do that? Well, one of the ways is the Army uses a model called the Army Force Generation Model, and it's a five-year model for the reserve components. And what that means is you spend, of that five-year model, one of those years, certain units in the Army Reserve will be available for missioning throughout the globe.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the ways that we stay ready and relevant is to be used. So the analogy that I've used with other people is if you study a foreign language but then you don't use it, you'll lose your capabilities.
Sure.
We've developed this great language called the Army Reserve, and if you don't use it, you'll lose that capability. And so the best way to keep that capability is to use it in the available year of the ARFRGEN model. But there's two other ways that I think we can do that. One is besides just using our select Army Reserve units in the available year, the other is to do a couple of things. One is to train with the active Army and all of the Army, to include the Army National Guard, through these enabling exercises that we call WARxs and CSTXs, which the Army Reserves is uniquely equipped to offer that level of training. These are large DIRT exercises, field training exercises, with embedded leader and staff training through simulation training. When you integrate all that together, we can provide very well-integrated training for all of those enablers we've been talking about during the dialogue this morning, and that is the engineers, the logisticians, the transporters, the civil affairs, and we do that for the whole Army. So one of the ways you stay part of the Army is you train and work with the Army day in and day out throughout that ARFRGEN cycle, not just during the available year. The other way that we're doing this is we're working up a plan with the Army 357, Lieutenant General Campbell, to align the theater commands in the Army Reserves with ASCCs and COCOMs, which are Army Senior Service Commands and Combatant Commands around the globe. Specifically, there's unique capabilities in the Army Reserve that don't exist in the Army or the Army National Guard. One of those areas are theater commands. So we have, for example, two theater engineer commands that exist only in the Army Reserve. We have special medical commands, special civil affairs commands. What we want to do is to provide stability and better connectivity to support that joint force is to align those theater commands day in and day out with certain ASCCs and COCOMs, and they'll provide that staff planning and coordination on a routine and regular basis so we can engage the Army Reserves more effectively throughout that ARFRGEN cycle. An example would be, let's take AFRICOM. AFRICOM doesn't have any assigned forces to it, but one of their needs in Africa are medical support. So part of their theater security cooperation plan would be to use enablers like doctors and medical professions to help meet the needs of the continent as it is determined by that combatant commander. I want to be able to take some of my medical units, and in reserve status, they would go over to Africa and provide those types of training environments where they're providing that medical support as determined by the AFRICOM commander and staff. And one of the ways to do that is to put additional reservists on his staff to help them plan and integrate those Army reservists throughout the year and throughout that ARFRGEN cycle. Does that make sense?
Yeah. So these would be positions or billets that are permanently dedicated to reservists. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's exactly right.
Contrast that, if you would, with how this has worked before, because I would assume that there have always been reservists serving in an active capacity in COCOMs. How is this different from that?
Well, what we're trying to do is we're trying to increase the number of reserve positions. We used to do this for training only, and we called it capstone. Well, capstone worked pretty well. So what we've decided is let's go back to that capstone concept, but let's make the alignments permanent, of course, as approved by the U.S. Army, in order to provide that routine and regular support to those ASCs and COCOMs throughout the year, which will generally focus on training opportunities, but it also might involve opportunities in the available year. Recently, there was 12304 Alpha and Bravo passed as part of the National Defense Act of 2012. It allows for Federal Reserve, which the Army Reserve is Federal Reserve under federal control, mm-hmm. to be utilized to do a couple things. One is support missions in the continental United States, but also to support missions that are not in a combat zone outside the United States, i.e., going back to our example in Africa. So they have to put those mission requirements into the budget, but then we could, in turn, in that available year, maybe we don't have a combat mission for an Army Reserve unit when they come up in the ARFAGEN model in the available year. So instead, we might take that medical unit, that engineer unit, send them over to Africa or Southern Command, where they would do engineering projects or medical support to meet the needs of that that area of responsibility. So it's another way of using the Federal Reservists, because remember, as I said up front, if you don't use us, you'll lose that capability.
Sure. And I would imagine most individual reservists want to be used, but how much say is an individual reservist going to have over whether or not he or she deploys in that available year or gets used in these reserve capacity interim missions?
Well, actually, I think the good news is most of the people that are in the Army Reserve are in the Army Reserves because they like what they do. Mm-hmm. They're excited about being utilized to do missions that may be combat-related or not combat-related. So I think the greater risk is if you don't use them, they're going to vote with their feet. They're going to leave the Army Reserve because the reason they joined the Army Reserve to begin with was to do great and exciting things in the U.S. and abroad to support the needs of the nation. I think a bigger question would be how often can you use them and keep that employer-family balance that we talked about earlier? And I think the studies and the dialogue the Army and others have had with the employers is we found that the ARFAGEN model, that's that five-year model for reserve components, is about right. That we think, regardless of whether you're the private or public sector, if we give you predictability, you know well in advance of when you're going to be in that available year and then possibly gone from your employer and family, as long as we give you enough notice, as long as that's predictable, then the families and the employers can support it.
Have you gotten feedback from employers on that exact topic?
I have, and so far the feedback has been, you know, very positive. That what they're looking for is the same thing the soldier wants, the same thing the family wants, is predictability and having enough notice, if you will, to plan accordingly to cover down on the job associated with that reservist when they're gone in their civilian organizations. And as a guy that came from the private sector and who's a private business owner in Arizona, you know, I understand exactly what they go through in terms of cash flow and mm-hmm. how do you keep, the requirements moving when that quality civilian employee who's a reservist is now gone, how do you backfill for that person? And so I'm very sensitive to that as an individual who came from that background.
Lieutenant General Jeff Talley, the new chief of the Army Reserve. When we come back, we'll hear more about what individual Army Reservists can expect as the Reserve tries to keep them operational in a post-war environment, and how the Reserve will have to do less with less in a time of declining budgets. This is on DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Thanks for listening to On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. Our guest this week for the hour is Lieutenant General Jeff Talley, the new chief of the Army Reserve, who, as he mentioned earlier in the show, is working in a different environment than his predecessor. Wars are coming to a close and budgets are winding down. He talked with me about what reservists can expect in a post-war deployment cycle and how the Reserve will have to do less with less.
When you talk about the folks that are going to be used in that available year, I guess one of the things I wonder, is there any way to characterize what proportion of the reserve that's in those enabling capabilities is going to get used in that available year? Is it 90%? Is it 40%? Any idea?
Yeah, the short answer is, you know, it's hard to predict the future. But what I can say is the demand signal for the Army Reserves is staying pretty consistent. As I mentioned up front, since most of this combat support and service support for our Army rest in the Army Reserve, mm-hmm. that means the Army is going to continue to rely pretty heavily on the Army Reserves for those enabling capabilities that we've been talking about. What number is that? Well, in that available year, we'll have about 25%, give or take, of the total Army Reserve ready to go across a variety of skill sets to meet any global mission that the Army and the Joint Force needs for the Army Reserves. Mm-hmm. Does that mean all 25% of the Army Reserve that's in that available year is going to go? No, it'll be something less than that. But right now, the demand signals, we think, as long as we maintain in the available year at least a quarter of the Army Reserve completely ready at the highest level of readiness, that'll be more than sufficient to meet the needs of the nation. We can provide more than 25% without having any negative impact to the Army Reserve and to the families and soldiers But right now, we think it'll probably stay at about that level.
And as time goes on, do you see those reserve capabilities, those reserve-specific capabilities changing or evolving? I'm thinking of things like cyber that we're going to need lots of people for in the future.
That's a great question, and that's a dialogue that the Chief of Staff of the Army, General O and General Odierno and others are having right now. Is the cyber command and the cyber focus for the nation is critical to the defense of the United States and our allies, and the Army Reserve plays a big role in that. So we actually have cyber units already up and operating and well integrated with the U.S. Army Cyber Command. We see that as a growth industry, and we will probably increase the size of our cyber operations within the Army Reserves to better support the Army in the joint fight.
And how do they operate? Are they just, you know, contributing on their drill weekends at Cyber Command, or do they get activated for long periods, or is it a mix of all those things?
It's a combination. We have individual units that provide capability, but then we have individuals, IMAs, individual mobilization augmentees, that have special civilian acquired skills that in turn easily support the needs of Army cyber. For example, whether it's cyber or some of these other specialties, as you might very well imagine, the cyber warrior is the guy or gal that has that civilian expertise that may have worked for Microsoft or Google or have those skill sets, and they've decided to join the Army Reserves. And so we're tapping into, again, those civilian acquired skills and experiences. But that's the common theme throughout all the Army Reserves, whether we're talking cyber or engineering or medical or military intelligence, all of those sorts of things build upon the civilian acquired skills and experiences that those Army Reserve soldiers maintain.
Mm-hmm. You talked earlier about being understrength in some categories. Are there areas where you're overstrength? And what are you doing to try and balance that out?
That's a great question. We are overstrength in E1 through E4. So when you look at those initial entry privates through specialists, the Army Reserve is actually overstrength. We have too many privates to specialists. And then when you get to the NCO ranks and the officer ranks, we're actually short. So what are we doing? It's actually three things. One is working more closely with U.S. Army Recruiting Command, Major General Mann, who's a great officer and leader. We're working with him to maybe reduce the number of recruits that we're bringing into the Army Reserve. The second thing we're doing, going back to the point that you made earlier, is we're short in those mid-career NCOs and officers. So we are putting transition coordinators on the active duty installations to help offer opportunities to the active component NCOs and officers as they come off active duty. And then the third point is we have our own recruiting retention system within the Army Reserves, and we're specializing or focusing those efforts to make sure that, one, we spend more time on prior service soldiers coming into the Army Reserve, mm-hmm. and maybe cutting back on some of our E1s to E4s.
As far as that transition process into those grades that you're trying to fill out of the active Army, is there a partnership with the active Army on that, or is it kind of up to you to go out onto the installations and take care of that ingestion process into the reserve?
Yeah, there is a partnership effort. The first one is a partnership with the U.S. Army Recruiting Command, which is an active component command, as I mentioned, that General Mann commands.
Yeah.
The second is partnering with Human Resources Command, of which 58%, I think, of all the Army full-time soldiers that work in Human Resources Command are Army Guard Reservists. They're AGRs from the Army Reserve. So between partnership with Human Resources Command, HRC, U.S. Army Recruiting Command, and our own internal efforts within the Army Reserve Command, we're able to get after that requirement.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so those are your sort of human resource challenges. Let's talk about some of your other resource challenges. You mentioned toward the beginning of the show that the fiscal environment that you're working in is dramatically different than what your predecessor had. What are your biggest worries, your biggest concerns as we go forward, especially with sequestration possibly on the horizon here?
Yeah, I get asked a lot about sequestration and continuing resolution, and are you worried about the funding and resourcing for the Army Reserve? And the short answer is I don't worry about it a whole lot, because right now, of the three components of our Army, active, guard, and reserve, the Army Reserve is probably sitting in the best position in terms of minimal reductions in terms of resourcings and capabilities based upon different scenarios that may or may not happen in the future regarding funding. The thing that I worry more about from the funding perspective is not how are we going to get our missions done. We will certainly have reduced resourcing associated with the Army Reserve. People will say, well, you have to do more with less. I don't say that. What I say is we'll do less with less. But that's okay, because what do leaders do? Leaders set priorities.
Mm-hmm.
Not everything has the same priority. So as leaders, we'll set priorities and we'll do the right things for the Army Reserve to best support the Army. And so as funding comes down, we'll make those tough decisions. I'm more worried about not just reduced funding. I'm really worried about is how do we communicate that to the formations? I don't want captains and colonels that are out in the field and first sergeants and sergeant majors worried about operational or strategic funding issues that may or may not be being dialogued in the Pentagon and elsewhere. I want them to focus on the basics, shoot, move, and communicate, maintaining individual, leader, and unit readiness, and not worry about the funding piece. Let me and others worry about that. And so what I do focus a lot of attention on is let's make sure we send a calm, cool, and accurate message to the field so they're not panicking over potential funding scenarios that may in fact not happen.
Mm-hmm. You talk about doing less with less. Any hints you can give us as to things that you will stop doing, or is that not knowable yet?
Well, I think one of the things is we, you know, just like in the private sector, the government has to gain some efficiencies. And I already started off the show by saying I think the Army Reserve is a great investment for America, and we already have those efficiencies inherent to the reserve component. But we can always do better. One of the ways that we have to do better is we won't have the same level of funding to do extended active duty training that we may have had in the past. Because in the past, you would get mobilized, and then we could train you at a training station, and then you'd go overseas. So we have to do more home station training. So that means making more use of live virtual constructive training, so more use of simulators, for example. Mm. And so the good news is we have that capability in our Army, and we just need to make more use of using simulation training as it makes sense in order to minimize travel expenses, in order to minimize cost of training. Now, going back to that R4Gen model where you've got that five-year model, I think the way of looking at this is you get to the left of that model early in the model, we're going to spend more time doing simulation training because we can accept higher risk. But eventually, when you get closer to that available year, we've got to certify that you're ready through live training in the field, which would include simulation training. So the key is to make better use of home station training mm-hmm. and simulation training throughout our training model.
But as far as specific mission sets, there's none that you can sit here and say, I see this going away in the coming years.
Not for the Army Reserve. Again, mm-hmm. because we represent that support piece for the Army, right now there's no indication that any of our specific capabilities will in fact go away or be reduced. In fact, just the opposite. There'll be a steady demand for them regardless of whether we have increased activity overseas or not. There's going to be a steady demand signal for the Army Reserve, and we're ready to meet that demand.
Lieutenant General Jeff Talley is Chief of the Army Reserve, just sworn in June. We'll come back after one more break and get his thoughts on the rising tide of suicides in the Army, something the Reserve is by no means exempt from. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. I'm Jared Serbin. We're back on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. We're talking this week with Lieutenant General Jeffrey Talley, the new chief of the Army Reserve. The entire military is seeing a disturbing trend of suicides among service members, both on active duty and in the reserve component. The Army alone saw a spike of 38 potential suicides this July, double the month before. Many observers have noted that the U.S. is now losing more warfighters to suicide than to armed conflict. I asked Talley what we know about the reasons for that trend and whether there are issues with suicide that are particular to the reserve component of the military.
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, we talked about financing earlier. There's two things that keep me up at night. One is, are we communicating the resourcing, the financial piece in a cool, calm way to the field so they don't panic, which is a point that I've already mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
But more important than that, the thing that keeps me up is suicide. Suicide is a tragedy in our society. And the Army is, of course, a reflection and part of our society. And so what we've experienced is you're exactly right. We are now having more deaths due to suicide than combat losses, both in the active Army and in the Army Reserve. The challenge we've got there is how do you stop or defeat that enemy called suicide? And I will just tell you, not only myself, but all the leaders of the Army are working every day to try to find a way to defeat that enemy. There's no simple solution. There's no silver bullet to defeat the enemy called suicide. We have demographics. We've studied it ad nauseum. And the numbers that we find in the Army Reserve that are interesting is most suicides in the Army Reserve are committed by single soldiers, not soldiers that are married and have families. Hmm. Most of them are committed by soldiers that may have not deployed or may not have multiple deployments. So we haven't necessarily seen a direct connection between Army Reserve soldiers who have been mobilized and deployed and having a higher suicide rate than those that haven't.
Hmm.
What we do see pretty common is most of the time there's a financial stress and a failed relationship that somehow is coupled into the suicide equation. My thoughts on it are society is very complex today, much more complex than in the past, and that our Army Reserve, which is predominantly made up of young people, that we don't have the same type of coping skills today as we did in the past. And so what happens is you've got these young men and women doing their nation's bidding by being members of the Army Reserves, also trying to have civilian careers, trying to have that balancing act. They get into a failed relationship. They get into financial issues. They may turn to alcohol and drugs. And then, unfortunately, that enemy suicide ends up coming into the equation and taking their life. And we haven't found any single solution. But one of the things that I'm doing in the Army Reserve is I issued a suicide stand down where our commands are taking a more proactive look at how we're assessing and reaching out to our soldiers. And the Army has recently come out with a mandated suicide stand down, which will occur on the 27th of September.
Mm.
And so the idea here is to make sure that we're doing everything we can in the field. So I think we have to go back to the older days where we just have to know our soldiers better, to know their personal situations to the degree that we can better, situations with their families, their employers, their finances to the extent that we can, and try to make sure that they understand that they're part of our Army family. And there's no problem that they have that we can't, together, working with them, help them solve. And that's kind of what we're doing. We call these at risk. These soldiers are at risk. And there is a certain population within the Army Reserve that the suicide population comes from. And those at-risk soldiers are what we call non-participants. These are soldiers that are in the Army Reserve that don't come to work. They don't come to drill regularly. They're not actively engaged in the unit. They're not the guy or gal that come to every drill, that come to their annual trainings, that
are
active with
family
programs. They're somewhat disengaged.
Yeah.
And, of course, they're committing their suicides or apparent suicides when they're not in a military setting for the most part. And so what we've got to do is reach out to those non-participant communities and try to find a way to bring them into the Army Reserves in a more integrated way.
I mean, that sounds like a difficult challenge. And one of the things, I guess, that separates the reserve components from the active components is when the active guys come home from combat, they're generally coming home to a military community and a pretty well-established support network, one would hope in most cases. Not always true with reservists, right?
Well, we actually, in some cases, the reserve component is pretty darn strong in terms of our family support programs, and we are a community-based force. The Army Reserve is a community-based force like the Army National Guard.
Mm.
And so in many cases, we're strong or stronger than what you see in the active component as far as those community-based integration. The challenge is that system isn't always integrated with the unit. Okay, so when they come home, they demobilize from the mobilization site, and then they go off to maybe seven states. Mm. And then so how do you maintain that day-to-day contact? Because maybe they seem okay when they first get home, but what happens is over the next 6 months, they start to have problems, and you weren't able to pick up on that because you're only with them for 2 or 3 weeks at the mob site. I mean, we certainly have Military One Source. We have special counseling. We have lots of programs in the Army and the Army Reserves to reach out to soldiers. But I think your point is one that I would agree with. Is it easier for the active component to maintain command and control, if you will, over their soldiers when they return back from deployment or from any sort of training environment? The short answer is yeah, because they have them all the time. We only have them once a month, a few weeks in the summer. And so it's much harder to know what that reserve soldier is doing when they're not actually at battle assembly or on active duty.
General Talley, it's been a really interesting hour. Really appreciate you spending so much time with us, and congratulations on assuming command here.
Well, thanks so much for the opportunity to talk about the Army Reserve and what a great investment we are for America, and Also important to me is it's great to meet another person from the great state of Arizona.
Indeed. Go Sun Devils.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Lieutenant General Jeff Talley is the new chief of the Army Reserve. And to hear our recent show with his predecessor, Lieutenant General Jack Stoltz, now retired, or any of our past shows, visit us at federalnewsradio.com. Just click on the shows page and scroll down to On DoD. This is On DoD on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Glad you could join us. I'm Jared Serbin. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, Wednesday afternoons at 2, only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.